In this present crisis, government is not the solution to our problem. Government is the problem.
This is the I Spy Radio Show.
You and I have a rendezvous with destiny.
Keeping an eye on big government.
We the people tell the government what to do. It doesn't tell us.
The trouble with our liberal friends is not that they're ignorant. It's just that they know so much that isn't so.
And now, here is your host, Mark Anderson.
Thank you for joining us today on the iSpy Radio Network, Oregon's second largest radio network, where every week we help you keep an eye on big government. You know, America's belief in God runs deep in our culture and our psyche, but it's under attack more today than perhaps at any time since our nation's founding. Historians generally agree on four great awakenings in America's past, and we'll have a future show on these later this summer. The last of these great awakenings immediately preceded the Reagan Revolution. Now that the Republican crop of nominees seems complete, are we looking at another Christian revolution? Has the groundwork been laid? What's missing? Will Christians, evangelicals in particular, take a role? Today, we'll be talking with Dr. Bruce Thornton of the Hoover Institution to find out what were the cultural sparks that set off the Reagan grass fire, to find out if those same elements are there for another revolution, or if this has the elements of a failed coup. Also, in the wake of yet another attack by a Muslim on Americans, this time unarmed soldiers at a recruiting station, the president and his advisors are mystified why this happened. Somehow it just does not compute that this might be part of their culture. And so we're at another clash of cultures, not just evangelicals versus secular, but also Christians versus Muslims. Dr. Thornton is an expert on Muslim ideology, and we'll get his thoughts on that as well. Dr. Thornton, welcome to the show. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you. It's my pleasure.
Yeah, you know, Christianity, particularly evangelical Christians, played a huge role in the 1970s and the 1980s. First Carter and then Reagan. But the two were really polar opposites policy-wise, but garnered votes from those same voters. So obviously, a lot of evangelicals voted for Jimmy Carter. Mm-hmm. Do you think that they did that simply because he told everyone he was a born-again Christian?
Oh, I think so. You know, as a governor, he didn't have much of a record for people to judge. I had no foreign policy experience, obviously, from an important state, but not a big state, not like a California or New York or a complicated state. And I think a lot of people, you know, saw that he was a Christian. He wasn't ashamed of talking about being a Christian, and there's no question that that contributed a lot. But we shouldn't fail to mention the other dimension of his attractiveness. He was not Richard Nixon. You know, and the Watergate and the whole Vietnam, you know, issues. I think both of those together helped get him elected.
Yeah, I think that's very true. I think they wanted somebody that had some sense of integrity because that was clearly missing there with the Nixon administration.
Right.
But what's interesting, though, is in that time, those same voters who turned out in droves for Carter then turned against him in the 1980 election with Ronald Reagan. And when you think about it, especially in hindsight, that's a pretty big shift going from a Carter to a Reagan. Very different men and very different policies. Why do you suspect the change there?
Well, the main thing is once Carter got into office and they saw what a terrible president he is and how ineffective he was, they started to have buyer's remorse. Hmm. And probably many people realized that, you know, he may have sounded good about going to church and praying and lusting after women in his heart and such, but that, you know, they wanted somebody who could run the ship, and he was awful. He was awful upon the, you know, the oil crisis and the energy crisis. And then, of course, the Iranian hostage crisis was what really did it in. He was feckless and weak on that. His whole administration was. And I think people started wanting somebody who was not just, you know, nominally Christian, but also understood that Christianity was part of what it meant to be an American, and they were tired of people being ashamed of being American or saying that, you know, America's responsible for all the world's ills. I think they managed to put those two together, that confidence in America and confidence in Western civilization came from a recognition of the centrality of the Judeo-Christian tradition. And so, they, you know, the one reinforced the other.
Hmm. Well, do you think, though, that by the time Reagan rolled around, were evangelicals maybe a little bit more politically savvy? Would that also explain why they jumped more onto Reagan's bandwagon than jumping off of Carter's?
Yeah, absolutely. Again, they saw that the practical policies that had been coming from the 60s and the 70s, and I'd say obviously Roe v. Wade and abortion was one of the biggest, but the whole culture had changed so much in the 60s. Whether you're talking about, you know, more public sexuality, public homosexuality, all of these things, these cultural movements, it just disturbed people, you know, because they were anti-Christian at their core, most of them. And they connected the foreign policy issues, the economic issues, they connected all of those to what they had seen in the breakdown of the Judeo-Christian consensus in the 60s. And they just got fed up. I think people just reached the point where they wanted a change, and they wanted the pendulum to swing back to, you know, a public morality founded on the Judeo-Christian tradition. And I think that was a lot of Reagan's appeal. And it was his confidence, I think, that was so important. Remember, Jimmy Carter gave his crisis of confidence speech. Sometimes it's known as the malaise speech, although he never used that word. But, you know, you can go online and read it, and it's really interesting to go back and read that. Read his inaugural address. I had occasion to just recently refresh myself on it. And just reading that and the Notre Dame speech, the so-called crisis of confidence speech a few years later, you read those, and you could see how attractive Ronald Reagan was, you know, because he was confident and he wasn't ashamed about what he believed and about saying America was great. And he was a brilliant politician. I mean, let's not forget that, too.
He was a brave politician, something that's sadly missing today. But like you said, there was that crisis of confidence about Carter. I know what you mean, because I read your article on Carter versus Obama, and we'll get to that later. But it's interesting in that if you read some of Carter's speeches that you highlight there, if you didn't know it was him, you'd swear it was one of Obama's speeches. They sound almost identical in terms of their outlooks and what's causing all the ills in today's society and in the global community.
No, there's no question. I mean, that you mentioned that article. That's what struck me. A quick example, in talking about dealing with, you know, I would call them failed or rogue or thug nations like Iran. I mean, there's a little expression that recurs repeatedly in Carter and in Obama's, and it's mutual respect. You know, we want to deal with you on the basis of mutual respect. And that wasn't true of the Soviet Union in the 70s. They did not have any respect. The only thing about the United States the Soviet Union respected was our military power. And that's exactly the case today with Iran. And neither one made any, you know, bones about it publicly in their pronouncements.
Yeah.
And so it's a shorthand way of seeing the continuity of this failure of nerve on the part of our leaders, this tendency to apologize and to be guilty about our alleged sins, and then simply not understanding the nature of the adversary
or the
rival or the enemy. And when you say, well, we want to have mutual respect, they don't respect anything except force.
No, it's idealism versus reality, unfortunately.
Exactly.
All right, let's go ahead and take a break right here. Talking with Dr. Bruce Thornton of the Hoover Institution about the seeds of the Reagan Revolution and whether we're ripe for another one. And welcome back to the iSpy Radio Show. We're talking today to Bruce Thornton. Dr. Bruce Thornton. He's a research fellow at the Hoover Institution. He is also a Shulman Journalism Fellow at the David Horowitz Freedom Center. Today we're talking about the seeds of the Reagan Revolution and the role of Christians in that election. If you remember, evangelical Christians played a huge role in getting Reagan elected. And lately they've been, you know, I guess you could say, dormant. So today we're looking at whether they could play a role in next year's election. You know, we were talking in that last segment there about the increasing political savvy of the evangelical Christians as they moved from Carter to Reagan, in large part in reaction to Carter's policies. And moving into Reagan, they had that deeper focus on policy. But I think also in large part, which you alluded to, was that Reagan was really proud to be a Christian. Maybe not an evangelical Christian, but it was clear that he was, in fact, a Christian, that this was a Christian nation with a Judeo-Christian heritage, and that went hand-in-hand with the conservative movement at that time. So looking back at that and the 30 years since Reagan, how have we gotten so far removed culturally from that era to where that's almost unrecognizable to today's culture?
Well, the whole story of modernity, if I can widen the lens a little bit, I mean, by that I mean the development of the West since the 18th century has been increasing secularization. That is, the pushing of religion and faith more and more from public life, from the public square, from political life. And, of course, the 60s was a huge leap in that process that had been already ongoing for quite a while. And in the subsequent, 50 years now, it has increased. And there's a lot of reasons for that. I think that the growth of mass media has been a factor in that. The shifting of standards on television and the movies, et cetera, the proliferation of media, particularly the internet. Let's not forget what the biggest thing people watch on the internet is pornography. You know, growing affluence, I think there's a strong link between affluence and secularization. People who are physically comfortable and materially well off tend to not think about religion as much, of the soul, of the afterlife, of all those sorts of things. The change in the public schools curriculum and the philosophy of the public schools, which moved towards what I would call scientism, the idea that the ancient problems of human behavior and human nature can be reduced to what some believe are sciences, like psychology, sociology, et cetera, but which really aren't sciences. One example of this, I think, is interesting, is the growth of environmentalism. In the public schools, you know, and which is basically it's a religion.
Sure,
it's a kind of cult.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, recycling, everybody knows recycling doesn't really do that much for the environment. You know, constructing a Prius and the battery and disposing of the battery creates a larger carbon footprint than anything you're going to save drying it. So you get these symbolic, almost cult-like sorts of beliefs that push for religion aside because they are cast as science versus ignorant superstition. And that really got into the public schools, into the universities, and that had a huge effect. I mean, we're three generations now into that process. So that shrunk, I think, that has shrunk the space that faith once occupied. I mean, even 50, 40 years ago, if you'd said that we're going to take a creche at Christmas time off of the courthouse park because a tiny handful of atheists don't want it there, and we will do it, that would have been astonishing even 40 years ago. You see what I mean? And that's a lot of it. It's just secularization has advanced so much more. And I know some people are going to say, because the media is always telling them this, oh, the United States is a really Christian nation. We're kind of fundamentalist, you know, kind of like the Taliban or something, you know, in the truth. All you have to do is just flip through your cable television channels, you know, and television and movies, and look at the number of abortions, and look at what's happened now with gay marriage, for example, and all of these things. And I don't see how you can say this is a fundamentally Christian nation. You can take surveys of people saying how often they go to church, right, and whether they believe in a heaven or a God, but that's not really the marker of a truly religious nation, right? You see it everywhere you go when it's really there. You see it in people's behavior, and you see it in what they will not allow into the public square, et cetera, and that's all gone. So, you know, that process has advanced since 1980 and Ronald Reagan, that process has advanced enormously.
Well, do you ever see a possibility for us to be able to head back in that direction? Because, you know, you're right, is that we've really replaced religion with basically belief in science, and that's now driving the culture. Is it science is driving the culture rather than religion and focus on morals? Do you ever see us being able to head back in that direction?
Well, the short answer is, historically, people turn back when some catastrophe, right, focuses their mind and exposes the inadequacy of a purely materialist view on life. That's usually what it takes. It's not going to happen through argument, I don't think, or putting Ten Commandments on the courthouse wall and all these other little battles that some people of faith are fighting. I think it requires people to be reminded that this life and the material things in this life are not reliable, and they're not the sum total of what you are. And when they go, that sometimes brings people's minds back to what really is permanent about us.
Yeah, great points. All right, let's go and take a break right here. Coming up, we'll be talking some more about the role of Christians in the Reagan Revolution and whether those same seeds are in play today. And you almost have to ask not whether God is dead, but whether Christian voters are dead. Stay with us. And welcome back to the iSpy Radio Show. Talking today to Dr. Bruce Thornton, talking about culture wars, really, and the role of the Christian voter in today's society, and also their role in the Reagan Revolution of 1980, and also asking what would it take to get Christians involved today? Will they rise up, or have they given up? As I said, we are talking with Dr. Bruce Thornton. He's a research fellow at the Hoover Institution. And let's continue our thoughts there on the Christian voter. There was an interesting article in Salon.com, and it says the I'll have to post that up on iSpyRadio.com. And here it is. Reagan's Christian Revolt, How Conservatives Hijacked American Religion. And one of the things that was really interesting in there is that they talked about how advocates of the religious right were rightly concerned to guard their own freedoms of religious expression and action. Yet they seldom had a theory of how to do the same unto others as they would have done unto themselves. That is, they rarely spoke of how to provide equal protection for religious and secular viewpoints with which they did not agree. So what are your thoughts on that?
That sounds to me utterly bizarre. I have no clue what they're talking about, you know. I cannot recall anybody other than some far fringe crank, and I don't even remember anybody there saying, yes, we want to bring religion back to public square, but just our religion, you know. We don't want those Catholics in there. We don't want, nobody's talking about Muslims back then. That wasn't an issue. Or we don't want Hindus. Or we don't want to, I never remember that. I mean, it's always been religious freedom from the beginning has always been inclusive. Because of the nature of Christianity in the colonies on the eve of the revolution. And we say, oh, well, they were all Christian. No, they weren't. They were all Christian, but they had very strong, contrasting, confessional distinctions among them. And that's why the founders said, look, we're not going to have a federal government establish religion because we have too many different sects and denominations. And they've always recognized that diversity, and they've always said that it is for all religions, as long as they are not pointedly opposed to the sort of civic religion, political religion. I'm going to have to go look that up and read the whole thing and try to figure out what it is. I mean, they seem to be applying that back in the 70s, evangelical Christians were wanting to bring Christianity back to the public square and exclude everybody else.
Yeah, that's kind of where they were going with that. It really was trying to be about more inclusive in terms of other religions and other, and they say even say secular viewpoints. But yeah, on the one hand, they thought evangelicals were inspired by their religion to get involved, seeing it as an opportunity to seize political power, which the authors, you know, that's what they're assuming their motives were here, that they'd have this political power to push their versions of morals into society. But it was focused on diversity that evangelicals didn't really have an easy answer of how to be inclusive of other Christian viewpoints that were not evangelically based, as well as secular viewpoints. But yeah, that was the author's thinking there, was that evangelicals wanted to kind of take over the culture. doctor, which is interesting because you could kind of make that viewpoint now, is that the seculars have taken over the culture, and they don't want the religion in there.
Absolutely. You're absolutely right. It's a great point. What their own sort of habits, beliefs on somebody else. They're the ones that are restricted and to admit that there might be, on the issue of abortion, for example, there might be a legitimate argument on the other side. There's only one position.
Well, but that's interesting, though, because you always kind of then seem to come down to an either or. And that's one of the things that, in fact, that article goes on to talk about is this notion of black and white, that evangelicals, especially their worldviews tend to be black or white. You're either Christian or you're not Christian, rather than kind of a range of gray in between. But in terms of abortion, you do kind of come down to an either or situation. It's either killing a baby or it's not killing a baby. What are your thoughts? I mean, how could you ever possibly merge those two different viewpoints where somebody says it's perfectly fine to kill a baby versus one that says, no, you are in fact killing a baby?
No, you can't. You can't. And the pro-life movement, I believe for cultural reasons at this point, are never going to get to the past, return to the past where abortion is illegal. So where the compromise has to come and what the states have been doing, and a great example of how federalism is supposed to work and how the founders wanted it to work, and that's to put various restrictions that minimize as much as possible some of the horrible things that, for example, have just been exposed by these Planned Parenthood tapes, lowering the limit on weeks of viability and making minor girls get permission or, at least talking to somebody first instead of just... But see, those kinds of... The interesting thing about the abortion movement is they are absolutist on protecting this, and that includes late-term abortion, that includes, selling organs, that includes letting a 15-year-old girl have the right to go in the life of what is a human being. I don't care what they say, it's a human being. And that's it. And if you're either for that or you're not for that, and if you're not for that, then you're some sort of religious nut or you're waging the war on women. And we've seen the same thing go on with gay marriage. The founders gave us a mechanism for this. It's called federalism. It's the, as somebody once called it, the notion of islands of intolerance in a sea of tolerance. If you didn't like Massachusetts state religion and taxes for supporting the state religion, which existed well into the 1800s, well, then you can move.
Yeah.
You can go someplace else.
That's right, yeah.
If I don't like California's lunatic politics and tax system, right, and we are the most lunatic state in the union, I have to say, if it bothers me that much, I can move to Texas or wherever. But once the federal government gets involved, this is the real issue.
Now there's just no escaping it, for sure. That's right.
There's no place to hide.
Okay, let's go ahead and take a break right here. We're talking with Dr. Bruce Thornton of the Hoover Institution about the role of Christianity in the Reagan Revolution and whether Christians will play a definitive role in the 2016 election. Stay with us, more on that. And thanks for staying with us on the iSpy Radio Show, talking today to Dr. Bruce Thornton about the role of evangelicals in the Reagan Revolution and looking at whether or not they will play a role in this next election as well. And I want to talk a little bit about what I think was so different now from then, which is that the cultural left has not only gained the upper hand in the culture itself, but they are also very deep into really every facet of government, legislative, executive, judicial, which gives them the means to legislate their ideology. And are we seeing the fruits of the Reagan Revolution in that so many conservatives of that generation went into business when they maybe should have gone into public service?
Well, that's an interesting question. I mean, it reminds me of how one of the explanations of why aren't there any conservatives in universities is because they go out and get jobs where they can make money. But it's self-selection, and I don't know what we can do about that. I don't know what sort of idea of public service. I think we get plenty of good people, running for office. We don't agree with everything, but I think they're well-meaning. I think they have the right values. We have to remember, we have a political system that was designed to be adversarial. And a lot of people forget That's true. They say, oh, well, how come they can't be bipartisan? How come they can't get together and solve problems? Well, if you bring James Madison from the other side of the grave and say that, he'd be horrified. We don't want them getting together. We don't want them, particularly the federal government, solving problems. We want local communities and counties and municipalities and states maybe solving problems, because problems should be solved at the lowest level possible, where the people are most directly aware of them and of the uniqueness of their situation. And the whole notion of competing factions balancing each other out so that no one faction could seize control of the federal government and limit the freedom of everybody else. You should always remember, the point of the Constitution was not to solve problems. It was to protect freedom.
That's right.
And what's happened in Madisonian terms is one faction, the progressive faction starting in the 1880s, 90s, right, which is centralizing power and giving more power to the federal government and extending its reach into more and more of our lives through regulations and coercive power. That's exactly what they were afraid of. So the question of, well, we need to put these good people into politics and they'll solve the problem. The federal government has grown now to the point where that would just be a start. But you still have to deal with the mentality, the entitlement mentality that is so ingrained in people's lives today. And that's the real issue. And on this score, even Ronald Reagan, and I admire Ronald Reagan, but let me give you one example. Everybody knows now that the Social Security disability insurance has been abused and expanded to a number that I think in 2016 that fund is going to be gone and it's going to have to be subsidized out of the general fund. Who passed the legislation that said unspecified mental disorders or back pain would make you eligible for Social Security disability? That was Ronald Reagan, and that was a huge mistake, because you allowed subjective criteria that cannot be scientifically or medically proven or disproven, and what has followed could have been predictable. You've had an enormous expansion of that program, and that's just one example of many. So now it's institutionalized. Now it's not unsolvable. It just takes a change in people's mentality to listen to the sorts of politicians that might want to try and reform these programs.
And you're right. That's the proverbial camel's nose under the tent, is once you start expanding that, it's, you know, it's
exactly.
Typical big government. It's just going to continue to expand.
Well, of course, and anybody can look up online the history of the Social Security program. It started in 1935 was when the legislation was passed. And look at its original aim and size and purpose, and then look at it today over the years.
Yeah.
Right? It has expanded and expanded and expanded. It has taken in more beneficiaries. It has increased the amount of benefits to the point now where it's unsustainable fiscally. And you can duplicate that with just about every government program.
Very true. I want to start shifting into some of Obama's failures and weaknesses here, especially that article that we mentioned previously, comparing Carter and Obama's foreign policy mistakes. So let's take a break a little bit early here. We'll have more with Dr. Bruce Thornton coming up after this. Stay with us. And welcome back to the iSpy Radio Show. I'm your host, Mark Anderson, helping you keep an eye on big government. And we are talking today to Dr. Bruce Thornton. He's a research fellow at the Hoover Institution, author of 9 books and political commentator. And I want to start shifting into one of those articles that you've written, and it's comparing Carter and Obama. And it's a really fascinating article in the sense that it's really kind of the race to the bottom in terms of who is going to be viewed as the worst foreign policy president ever.
Yeah, exactly. And at this point, I think Carter secretly is rejoicing, particularly over this Iran deal, because that pushes Obama ahead in that derby of shame. Remember the difference between Carter and Obama. Carter still had to deal with the nuclear-armed Soviet Union, a superpower rival. And that put limits on what you could do and what you couldn't do. That doesn't excuse him for not dealing with the Iran hostage crisis early on and forcefully, which really could have changed, I think, a lot of subsequent history. But it is always something that we have to keep in mind. A nuclear-armed rival, you can never just assume, well, they'll never use their bombs. You know, you just can't make that assumption. The stakes are too high. That makes Obama worse because right now the notion that, well, you know, we can't go to war with Iran. We either have to sign this deal or go to war with Iran. Well, there's an intermediate position. As soon as the negotiation started, as soon as there was something on Iran's part that was a dishonesty, that was, going back on and agreed upon something, a limited military strike at a target. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Could have focused their minds and brought them back to the table. Remember in 2003 when the U.S. invaded Iraq, March 2003, very quickly destroyed the largest army in the Middle East. Saddam Hussein ends up getting pulled out of a hole in the ground. Two things happened. Gaddafi said, please come and take my weapons of mass destruction and my chemicals, right? And Iran suspended its nuclear development program because you had the most lethal fighting machine in human history right on your border. That concentrated their minds. So this notion that we have to go to total war or we have to negotiate. No, you use diplomacy as an adjunct to the threat of force. But the threat of force has to be credible. And sometimes to make it credible, you have to use it. And that was never tried. And so that's the either-or fallacy that they're indulging in order to sell this this deal. And that was the same mentality as Carter, but Carter could argue, I think, speciously, but nonetheless, he could argue, you're right there in Iran, in the Soviet Union's back door, you don't know what sort of blowback is going to come from military action.
Well, and I think you're right, is that the Middle East mindset is one that respects strength. And at the time that happened in 1991, I was working at a hotel. I was the night manager, and the day manager there was actually an Egyptian national who had come over here. And he was convinced that America was in for a world of hurt once they invaded Iraq. And he mentioned that same thing that you did. This is like the world's fifth largest army, and they're very well trained and so on. And when we went in there and it just devastated their army in a matter of days, the next time that I went in there, that had happened in the in-between, I came in and he looked like somebody that he personally knew had been killed. I mean, he was just devastated.
Right. No question.
To see what the Americans had done to the Arab world's pride and joy.
Absolutely. And I can give you another example in the war in Iraq when they were fighting the Al-Qaeda in Iraq, particularly the two battles of Fallujah, the second battle of Fallujah, which is one of the great achievements of the U.S. Marines that nobody's ever going to talk about. The last thing in the world these jihadists wanted to face was a Marine.
Yeah.
Right? They did not want ever to face them in a stand-up fight because they would lose. That's why they had to resort to various kinds of guerrilla or insurgent kinds of tactics. And so they are not a foe that our military could not handle. The problem is, one, the rules of engagement that were politically inspired and forced upon our forces. And then second, the notion that we would have to go in and try to create some, you know, liberal democracy or some, you know, stable political order there.
It's misguided,
frankly.
Yeah, very misguided. In that article, you had mentioned that Carter was making the mistakes of blame America first. And we all know, of course, Obama blames America. But is Obama simply falling into those same kinds of mental mistakes in terms of Islamic countries, or is he actually advocating for Muslims? And the reason I ask that is because it seems like it's part of progressive ideology. Not only do you have to blame the wrongdoer, which in this case is America, you actually have to punish the wrongdoer and weaken them. At the same time, you strengthen the victim by giving them special privileges, I guess in this case, nuclear bombs. So what are your thoughts on that? Is this simply the same failing mindset, or is he actually advocating for a Muslim ideology?
Well, I don't know what is in his mind and what his motives are. I will say, though, that what he has done and what he has said is perfectly consistent with every university professor I've ever known in 40 years. There is nothing in his way he has governed or in what he has said that is inconsistent with that massive left-wing orthodoxy that has taken over so much of the culture. And one of the pillars of it is that the United States has been a rogue nation, a colonial imperialist power, which is historically yes. nonsense, responsible for most of the ills of the world. And its origins, of course, is in Marxism. Obviously, you know, as a successful liberal democracy, free market state, the United States had to be hated by anybody who was on the other side, who was of the Marxist persuasion, because the very existence of the United States discredited Marxism.
Yeah.
Marxism was supposed to empower the working class. Nobody empowered the working class the way the United States has.
Yeah, I still have not seen any Marxist leader ever give up their own mansion and give it to somebody less fortunate than them.
No.
Sorry, it just doesn't happen.
No.
All right, let's go ahead and take a break right here. We were talking about the culture wars, opposing forces in the culture war, progressives and conservatives and Muslims and Christians. Stay with us. We'll have more with Dr. Bruce Thornton. And welcome back to the iSpy Radio Show. We're in our final segment now, talking about the culture wars and the role that Christians may or may not play in the upcoming election. To do that, we're talking with Dr. Bruce Thornton. He's a research fellow at the Hoover Institution. And there was a video that was put out on LiveLeak.com earlier this year, and it was interviewing a retired admiral, and he had this to say: Islam is a political movement masquerading as a religion. He goes on to say, as far as a strategy, the Obama administration has a strategy. It's very simple that any American should be able to grasp it. It's anti-American, it's pro-Islamic, it's pro-Iranian, and it's pro-Muslim Brotherhood. So what are your thoughts about the admiral's comments on that?
Well, I think he's somewhat correct. I wouldn't say that Islam is a political movement masquerading as a religion. It is a religion in which there is no separation between political and the religious. That distinction simply does not exist. The religious is the political in our understanding of the word. And Sharia law is totally encompassing. It's everything. It's all of human life and everything you need to regulate human life, whether it's what we would call political, it's whether we would call private, things such as marriage or inheritance, everything. It's a unified, totalizing system. And it is deemed to be perfect as revealed, and so there should be no rival to it, including a secular government, parliament, and all that machinery. So I think he's right there. On the second part, you know, is he pro-Islamic? That's a little kind of extreme for me, that contrast. He's anti-American. He's anti-American in the sense that all leftists are anti-American. That is, they don't believe that America is exceptional. They believe that it has to atone for its historical sins that they claim. And are they pro? Well, they're pro anything that is a rival to American influence in that sense.
Earlier in the show, we talked about this freedom of religion, and that was how America was founded. And so now we're talking about Muslims versus Christians.
Mm-hmm.
And as you say, it is a political force in and of itself in the sense that that's part of the religion. There is no separation of church and state. It just is. So here we have America that is founded on freedom of religion. Can Christianity and Muslims coexist in America, or is it going to naturally come to a cultural confrontation?
Well, historically, that Islam can coexist with any rival political order as long as Muslims are a distinct minority. I mean, look at India. India has something like 150 million Muslims out of a population of about a billion. But when Muslims do not behave, there is a swift and usually violent reaction to that. In this country, we only have, I mean, they try to claim 5-6 million Muslims. I would say three tops, you know, out of 300 and some 20 million. So the issue isn't the same as it is for, let's say, France, which has 10%. Now, that's a different, order of integration there and difficulty. So, they can coexist as long as it's clear that when they stray beyond the bounds of religious observance into areas that we do not acknowledge as legitimately religion, there is a price to pay. Now, if we don't do that, as England has not been doing that, and they're probably the worst in Europe in not doing that, if we say, okay, you can carve out little areas of Sharia law where you do your own thing and we won't interfere with you, then there will be a problem. But if we're very firm about saying, you practice your religion, you do everything, but if you send money to a terrorist organization, right, that's going to be a problem. You know, if you start preaching sedition, right, it can be tied to actual behavior, then that's going to be a problem.
Yeah, it sure would.
As it would be with any sect, religion in this country. If you have an evangelical sect somewhere saying you need to get your guns and you need to go out and you need to shoot down an officer, I don't think that would pass muster as a legitimate practice of religion.
So we only got about a minute here with you. Do you see us heading to an event where Christians take a strong role in reversing the advance of progressive secular culture? In other words, are the seeds of what led to the Reagan Revolution, have they been planted, or are the elements not fully there yet?
I don't think so. I tend to be pessimistic, but I don't think that the America of today or the America that will be in 2016 is the America of 1980.
Yeah.
Now, what are the margins are we talking about? Are we talking about 48% of the people that are right-thinking versus the rest? Are we talking about a 5 to 8%, 10% of people who swing one way rather than the other, and they can be moved back to the right side? I'm sorry, I can't even speculate about which is the case. I suspect an underlying groundswell of resistance and anger against what's been going on for the last 6 years. But one thing's for sure, 2016 November, we're going to find out the answer to this question.
That is absolutely true. Dr. Thornton, I want to thank you so much for your time today.
My pleasure. Anytime.
A couple things before we get going. Have you signed the petition yet for a convention of states? They need a minimum of 100 signatures from every legislative district. You know, our guest today, Dr. Bruce Thornton, mentioned the principle of federalism, that if you didn't like one state, you could move to another. Well, this follows right in line with that thinking, giving states a means to control an out-of-control federal government. Just head to iSpyRadio.com and look for today's show page. That's 5-30 if you're looking in the archives, and we'll put links to all of that right in there. Today's show has been about Christians and getting involved. But before we go, I'd just like to say that it's not about electing people to office that will advocate or legislate for your particular faith or religion. It's about electing people who won't stop you from practicing your faith or religion. Freedom and liberty are not about imposing your viewpoints on someone else. It's about stopping them from imposing theirs on you. It's time we remember that. We need to get back to the point where we realize America is not a means to impose one group's dominance over all, but rather the freedom for all to live and believe as they choose to. We can have two very different viewpoints, and that's just fine. And that means stopping one party or the other from using the federal government as a weapon. And that includes not using it as a weapon to impose their morality on you or your family. But one thing's for sure, sitting on sand and letting the cultural tide sweep over you accomplishes nothing. So take a stand and get involved, because like we say every week, the best information does you no good if you don't use it. Reagan, what do you think?
I do not believe in a faith that will fall on us no matter what we do. I do believe in a faith that will fall on us if we do nothing.
It's more than a show. It's self-defense. The I Spy Radio Show.